subject of if the High Court has made a mistake and has erred in its judgment, and then the people follow the ruling of the court, and then the court realizes that it has erred in its judgment, and it then reverses its decision. In the meantime, people have done wrong. People have done wrong al smach, by virtue of the power of the court. But people have done wrong. Interestingly enough, in the fourth chapter of the book of Leviticus, this is discussed. And the funny thing is, I decided to do this partly because of what we're studying now, partly because, just in terms of timing, I had to begin this roughly Parshat Vayikra. It takes me two to three weeks to do a job like this. So there are a few other things to do too. So, in fact, this was in that material of the first Parsha of Vayikra, but the kind of stuff that, frankly, you never pay attention to. I had never paid attention to it before. I'll show you what it says here. Fourth chapter of Vayikra. Here. This is how it says, In kol adat Yisrael yishgu. You already know from what we've studied this year, v'chol adat Yisrael. How would you translate that?
V'chol adat.
Right. Now you know that adat is not, you would assume here in the English it's translated, if it is the whole community of Israel that has erred. That's not the way it's understood in the Talmud. Talmud understands the whole of that Yisrael Yishku. If the entire court, if a court makes a wrong decision, okay, then ne'alam davar me'enei ha'kahal, and this matter is hidden before the eyes of the community. V'asu achat mikol mitzvot Hashem asher lo te'asena v'ashemu. And they do one of the mitzvot that they should not be doing, and they therefore become guilty. Then it goes on, verse 14. V'noda'ah ha'chatat. Never realized what that meant. Noda'ah ha'chatat means the court then becomes aware of the fact that it has sinned. Okay, that it has done wrong. V'noda'ah ha'chatat asher chatu aleha, where they have done wrongly about it. V'hikrivu ha'kahal par ben bakar l'chatat. And the community shall bring an offering of a par, of a bull, of the cattle, the chatat, for a sin offering. The heviu oto lifnei ol moed, and they shall bring it before the tent of meeting. Vissamchu ziknei ha'eda et yedehem al rosh ha'par. And the elders of the court shall lean their hands on the head of the bull. Well, there are in that first parsha of the Yikra a variety of unwitting sins that are dealt with. The shogeg. This is one that is where the court acts, and then the people act b'shogeg. And normally, if you have a sin offering, a chatat, a chatat is either a kivsa or a female goat or a sheep. This is a bull, so it's a different offering that's brought because qualitatively it's a different experience. Here you're dealing with authority that has done in error. It hasn't done it intentionally. And a lot of what the Gemara discusses is how could the court make such an error? It gives an example, for instance, as well. This is perhaps where saying that Avodah Zarah is not Avodah Zarah, that it is not prohibited to worship an idol. So then the Gemara says, how could a court make that kind of a mistake? A court can't make a mistake of that nature. because it's clear, all you have to do, it says any child who goes to school and reads the Bible knows that that's something that you can't do. So it can't mean that. So what could it mean? So instead it defines it as a case where the I just lost my train of thought, where it is something where the tzedukim will disagree. Where the tzedukim will disagree. That's code. That's code. Where it says the tzedukim will disagree, where the Sadducees will disagree. That is to say that this is an issue of Torah Shebaal Peh and not Torah Shebichtav. The Sadducees disagreed with the Pharisees in that they did not accept the authority of the oral law and the oral tradition. So in effect, the area which is the area of potential controversy is not the written law, because that's obvious. The area where the court really has to exert its authority is not in what is obvious, but what is not obvious. So the whole thing is just fascinating to see. Then the next thing that the Gemara discusses is, here's the cynics, they have become a shiver in it, that the Bala Kohen. Asher Nasi Yechta. Yechta. What's a Nasi? Do we say, assume that they have a Sanhedrin? Not what the Talmud understands it to mean. The Talmud understands it to mean the king. And here is fascinating, it goes into a discussion of whether the king is above the law. Whether the king is subject to the law the same way everybody else is subject to the law. That's a very important discussion in the history of law. The extent to which the king is subject to the law. And of course the king basically is subject to the law. In this system, the king is very much subject, but the king nonetheless has certain things that are different from the people, because there is a level of dignity of the king that is important for the community's life. The king has to maintain a certain separateness from the community. So even though the king may also err in his decisions, he has a separate sacrifice that's unique to the king, because the king is unique. He's subject to the law the same as everybody else, but nonetheless the procedures of atonement are in fact different from the normal procedures of people. And then there's a third category. The third category is Kohen HaMashiach. If a Kohen, if the high priest does similarly, the high priest has an area of decision making in the temple where there are certain ritual areas that the high priest can make judgments about whether something is tamer tahor, cases of tarat, things like that are put in the hands of the high priest. And the high priest may also make an unwitting error. And he has his own procedures. So it's really such. But then it goes from there. And it goes into a long discussion of all of these things. And then it moves the way the Gemara tends to move on these things. The next thing it discusses is, what if all three have done wrong? Who comes first? Who comes first?
What is who?
Let's say all three. We have a case where the court has made a mistake, and the king has made a mistake, and the high priest has made a mistake. Who brings the offering first? Who brings the offering first? So then it goes through that. Then it finishes that, and then it says, this is generally an issue in certain areas of the law. Let us say that captors capture Jews, and there are men and women, there are rabbis, and there are regular people. who comes first? If you have only enough money to redeem one person, which person do you redeem first? I never realized this is a whole area of medical ethics. This is the area of triage.
The water in the bottle in the rain.
Correct. This is also related to that. This is one of the areas of triage in medical ethics, where you have to say, of course, if it's a case of life and death in one hand and the other one needs a Band-Aid, that's easy. That's not what you're dealing with here. What you're dealing with here are two people who need kidneys. Okay? Two people need kidneys. How do you decide which one gets the kidney? And you have one kidney. How do you decide who gets the kidney?
Janie, you get it first.
Not necessarily true. You don't say that. Because the law of the United States is very responsive. This is very basic law in the United States. You may go to China and get it first, but not in the United States. And the question is, does it matter who the person is? For example, in the case that I gave you just before about the captives, you know what the answer to that is? Who comes first? The answer to that is the woman comes first.
Not the children?
No. No, you know why a woman?
Children.
Because she's subject to rape. The assumption is that when people will capture women, they will rape them. And therefore, in order to prevent the most likely of possibilities, which is it's something that the Torah is very against. The woman has to be redeemed first. So the interesting thing here is that you have a context, and you have to examine the context in terms of likely occurrences and the relative value of people, because people may have the same relative value, but you may make a difference in the way you treat them based on the nature of what may happen. What may happen in this case is because I had a case like this. I was acting as an advisor for Beth Israel Hospital a while ago, and this was in a case of a liver transplant. It was a time when there weren't many livers around, and we were trying to decide who gets the liver. It's interesting that the law. It became law in the state of New York that an alcoholic moves down on the list. Somebody who is a known alcoholic and who has had cirrhosis of the liver goes down on the list. Okay? Because the likelihood that nothing, we don't know that it necessarily happened, but there's a likelihood, it's not to punish the person, but it's because the likelihood is that liver will again be destroyed. Okay? So issues like that, in fact, are relevant in medical ethics. They all come in the Jewish law area from this tractate of Harayot, which we'll be finishing on Friday morning. So.
I think it's somewhat related. During the Holocaust, I don't remember the details, but it was somebody sponsored the drawing of people from the Holocaust, and it was decided to do it on the basis of their contribution, artistic, literary contribution. I don't remember the story, but it never really sat right with me.
Yeah, this is a real problem. It's a real problem. Jewish law, you're really not supposed to do that. Not supposed to. It may happen sometimes.
It may happen.
But generally speaking, in Jewish law, as in the law of the state, what usually ends up is that it's first come, first served. That turns out to be the law. It's first whoever appears first, whoever goes on the list first. You have to go according to the list, and you cannot jump up on the list. There is no way to jump up on the list. The list that is created in terms of when you get on the list is very frequently the determining factor, because there is simply no other way of creating an equitable situation. There's no other way of doing it equitably. So that's how this turns out. Yes.
It's very interesting that April 1st was the first day in Israel for a new law that transplant of body parts from the people who passed away, take the body part. It used to be Israel like all other world, you know, list, and medically if you need, if you're really the number one on the list and you need, you get it. But then they found out that a lot of the Orthodox don't want to contribute. So they had a list now in Israel that if you are on the list and you are a contributor, and there is another one medically exactly like you and you are not a contributor, the contributor will get
interest.
So
that's a law now?
April 1st. And what happened until the beginning of the year, about 2,000 people used to register as a contributor. The minute they knew about this law, 70,000 a day went and put their name on the list as a contributor.
Smart law.
So now there is no short of body part.
That's a smart law.
It's a very... It changed completely. It's the only country in the world now that has this benefit of, if you are part of it, you win it.
So very interesting. So that's another way to introduce a consideration that really is important.
Change the marketplace.
Exactly, it changes the marketplace. Very interesting.
So there's proposals in some of the states now to allow the right to buy one, because they feel that it should be a, you know, there'll be a clearinghouse price for one. No one's done it yet, but it's being discussed. Livers and kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the
probably it's on 1 foot, probably it's prohibited.
Right.
Prohibited. Because you can't put a value on the life. You just can't, and it favors the rich over the poor. So that you can't do that. It's very interesting. Interesting.
And with the court and the king and the priest, what are the criteria for bringing the offering?
And which one comes first?
I'm sorry? Yeah.
You mean which one comes first? It has a lot to do with verses. It's not abstract criteria. It's the way in which the verses are structured in this fourth chapter. Because, in fact, the court comes first, because when mention is made of the king, it is after the court. Just the way it's presented in the Bible. And implied in this, it's not said so much, but implied in this is in fact that the court takes precedence over the king. Because the court has a certain public responsibility. The king has a dignity. That's not the same thing as public responsibility. Because the king can make a decision, but it can affect the king and the king alone. Some things the king can make an effect, but they can affect everybody. But whatever the court does, and that's an issue that actually is discussed in the beginning of this, does the court have to follow its own decision in order to kick in the criteria for this parhel endavar, for this bullock to be brought, or is it enough if the people follow the court's decision? So here, in terms of the king, the king, in fact, may affect people, may not affect people. The court essentially affects people. The way in which the court is dealt with is that the bullock of the court doesn't, you have to, threshold kicks in when Rov HaTzibur, the majority of the community, follows the decision of the court. And if the majority of the decision does not follow the court, then
is there something that justice should come back first before ritual or before?
That's not.
No.
They're not interested.
Interesting that they kill an animal every time they make a mistake. Yeah. Animals, you know? Yeah. I mean, they don't correct the issue. They just killed another animal.
No, they correct the issue, too.
Oh, yeah, I have to correct the issue.
You have to correct the issue.
You have to correct the issue.
Part of the ceremony.
You need a form of expiation. Need an expiatory ceremony because the human being has done wrong. The institutions of state have done wrong. And in the Bible, it's the ceremony is essentially a blood ceremony. It's the life force of the blood that has to be put on the altar in order to create the expiation. And remember that every wrong also is a wrong that pollutes the temple. The temple itself needs expiation, because the central religious institution, this is very basic, this is the issue in the Catholic Church today, that when the institution does wrong, the institution has to be expiated. You have to expiate the institution itself. And it's not enough to expiate the individuals, but you have to figure out a way to ritually get past what has happened to the institution itself. So that's a lot of work goes on as well in what you read in Leviticus.
Right, and then have to expiate expiation for their sin first, simply because if the reason that they're tamei while they're ostensibly assisting the other levels of society in bringing their sin.
That comes up, I don't remember exactly how it weighs it, but that logic, that issue is raised.
But they also were the source of the problem.
Yeah. But no, but the point that you make is a point that is made in the Gemara. That is an important point. I don't remember offhand how that was dealt with.
Was when Aharon had to bring the car for his dedication to be taken, was that the first korban that he brought before that came before the other korban over in relation to the investiture of the God?
Yes. Yes. Okay, that's on Sunday. That's Friday. Now getting back to Wednesday. Housekeeping. There will be no class next week, nor the following week, because the following week is Yom HaShoah. That is the Yom HaShoah service of Ur Zarua. Is the next is pretty sure if I'm right. Is that right? It's Wednesday night, I think. Right. Okay. Okay, now let's pick up. I'm not sure exactly where you left off, but let's go over to 8A1. Joe told me that he didn't get to the Benot Tzlafchad, the daughters of Tzlafchad. Okay, let's start with that.
This is where we stopped.
Okay, good. That's where I had intended to start. 8A1 on the bottom left-hand side of the page. Now remember, let's go back here to 7b3. Down on the bottom, note 39. This is a quote that has been parsed now for a whole page of the Talmud. The quote is in the first chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. And I read it to you again. I'm reading note 39 on page 7b3. I commanded your judges, ba'eta hilemor, at that time saying, Shamoa ben achechem, hear between your brothers, ushefatatem, and you shall make judgment, tzedek, a righteous judgment, ben ish uvein achiv uvein gero, between a man and his brother and the stranger. Lo takiru panim b'mishpat, you shall not have favoritism in judgment. Kakatam kagadol tishma'un, hear the small as the great. Lo taguru mipnei ish, you shall not fear from anybody. Ki amishpat Elohim, because judgment is God's. The hadavar asher yikshem mikem, but the thing that is too difficult for you, takrivun elai ushmativ, bring it to me and I will listen to it. That's Moses speaking. Okay, va'atzavevchem, and I commanded you, or I shall command you. I commanded you at that time. Et kol advarim asher ta'asun, all the things that you should do. Okay? So here we are going to now parse, we're going to comment on that section of this first chapter of Deuteronomy, which is the Hadavar Asher Yikshe Mikem, the thing which is too difficult for you, Takrivu Neilai Ushmativ, bring it near to me and I will listen to it. Right? That's what Moses is saying now to the people. Okay. Now, go back to 8a1 down the bottom. The Hadavar Asher Yikshe Mikem, the thing that is too difficult for you. Amar Rabbi Chanina v'itema Rabbi Yoshaya. Rabbi Chanina says, and some say that it was Rabbi Yoshaya, Al davar ze ne'nash Moshe. Because of this matter, Moses was punished. Moses was punished. Shenemar, as it says, Vayakrev Moshe et mishpatan lifnei Hashem. Moses brought the matter, their matter of judgment, before the Lord. Okay? What's going on here? I think Gemara says, first of all, Moses did something wrong. What did he do wrong? Well, you know what he did wrong? He says, if there's some matter that's too difficult for you, bring it to me. What he should have said that after that was, and I will bring it to God. He doesn't say that. Right, so in other words, it appears as if Moses is depending upon himself to make a judgment about a matter that is not yet known. So these rabbis say that matter is the reason why Moses was punished. Now look at the way that he was punished. Shenemar, Vayakrev Moshe ad Mishpatam lifnei Hashem. Eventually, Moses has to bring their issue before the Lord. Now, whose issue is this? This is the issue of the Benot Tzlofchad, the daughters of Tzlofchad. This is the 26th chapter of the book of Numbers. Numbers 26.
27a.
Well, let's see. Numbers. Numbers 27. Vatikravna ben Notzlovchad ben Chefer ben Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe limishpachot Menashe ben Yosef ve'ele shmot benotav Machla, Noah, v'Chogla, u'Milka, v'Tirtza. The daughters of Tzlofchad, of the Menashe family, of the family of Menashe, son of Chefer, of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Menashe, the son of Joseph, came forward. The names of the daughters were Machla, Noah, Chogla, Milcah, and Tirza. They stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, the chieftains, and the whole assembly, at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and they said, doesn't know what they say, our father died in the wilderness. He was not one of the faction, Korach's faction. I don't know, he died. He wasn't punished for being a member of this group of Korach, who were the rebels, which banded against the Lord, but died for his own sin. And he has left no sons. He has left no sons. Let not our father's name be lost to his clan just because he had no son. Give us a holding among our father's kinsmen. So the obvious assumption is here that women didn't inherit. Women did not inherit. Assumption was behind the lack of inheritance of women that they would not inherit because if they would marry somebody from another tribe, the assumption being that they would become subject to their husbands, that if they inherited, then the property would go to the other tribe. So there is the precedence here. The men inherit and the women do not. This is a special case that we have here. This is a case where there are no sons. There are no sons. So the property will either go to the nearest male relative, which is certainly a way that you could solve the problem, or it will go to them. Okay, he has daughters. So it's really quite an extraordinary thing that the daughters had the temerity to bring the case before Moses. These are the Benot Slavchat. And if they become famous for this, because it's just an amazing thing that they do this. Okay?
This is Dung Nabi.
This is the same, this is the whole story of the Dung Nabi. It's what motivates all of that. It's just fascinating. So here you've got just daughters. Okay? In the Dung Nabi, you've got just daughters. Right? And here you've got just daughters. So Moses doesn't really know what to do. He doesn't know what to do with this. Now, why is that a punishment? Punishment is because, at least these rabbis are assuming, that God has a special relationship with Moses. And he reveals to Moses what his will is. And the divine will, as it is revealed, is always applicable to everything. But here is a case where the divine will was not revealed to Moses until Moses went and asked for it. Right? So that is a way of showing the lack of favor that Moses had in this particular case. Why was there a lack of divine favor? Because when he spoke of the issue of judgment, here in this context, he spoke in terms of himself being able to provide judgment. And really he should have recognized the divine at that stage. Okay? Now, I wanted to read to you the Rashi from the Chumash to these verses. And the Rashi reflects the Midrash. Rashi, as he usually does, summarizes the Midrashic approach to a particular subject, because the question that Rashi deals with in chapter 27, verse 1 is the anomaly here that the patronymic of these women goes back all the way to Joseph. That's not what you would have expected, because you would have expected it would go back to Menashe, the son of Joseph. Because remember, when the tribes finally are divided and the land is divided up, there is no tribe of Joseph. Okay? Because Joseph has two sons. So those sons are the tribes and not Joseph. So here, the patronymic, however, goes back to Joseph. So that's what Rashi comments on. The Mishpachat Menashe ben Yosef. The family of Menashe going back to Joseph. Lama Ne'emar, that's Rashi. Why do we need to know about Joseph here? Halokvar Ne'emar ben Menashe. It already says to us two words before that the family goes back to Menashe. Why do we have to know that it goes back to Joseph? Ela lomar lecha, in order to teach you, Lecha Yosef Chibeb et Haaretz. Joseph loved the land of Israel. Uvenotav, and his daughters, namely these Benot Tzolofchad, Chibavu et Haaretz. They loved the land of Israel. Shenemar, as it says, Tana lanu achuza. They say, give us a portion of the land. Okay? Ulelamedcha shahayu kulam tzadikim. They were all righteous. Shekol nishem ma'asav u'ma'asei avotav stumim. Everyone whose deeds and the deeds of his ancestors are hidden Uferat lecha hakatuv be'echad mehem, and the scripture only mentions one of them, liyachaso lishvach, in order to make a positive comment about them. The key issue here was, tznu lanu achuza, achuza bayit. If you remember, achuza in Zionism, when you would have an area that was even Tel Aviv.
They're in Achuza in Haifa, they're all neighborhoods.
Because they're neighborhoods, and these were holdings, land holdings. This was what they said. It is the words of the Venot Slochat, these women who said, we want an Achuza. We want an Achuza on the land. And it wasn't interesting that the tradition could have seen it, that they wanted it's Achuzat Bayit.
Before it became Tel Aviv.
Exactly, before it became Tel Aviv. It was called Achuzat Bayit. That's what it was called. All taken from here. This is where it comes from. It could have been interpreted differently. It could have been interpreted that they wanted property. It's just that they wanted wealth. But that was not the way it's interpreted. The Midrash takes it that they were the Zionists. The women were the Zionists. And right into modern times, there is this thread of female Zionism, which really has its roots here in the story of the Benot Slavchat.
You said that Moshe was punished because when he said, bring it to me, he didn't say, bring it to me, and I will bring it before God. That's why Moses did say, bring it to me and I will bring it before God. You think that the daughter of Slavchat will not come with this issue?
Well, the story would have been different, let's say, because I would assume that the determination would have been the same determination. The outcome would have been the same. Right? So it's just a little hard to figure out how the narrative would have presented it.
My question is about why the punishment, what if the punishment is, because the case would come in front of him.
This is not only your question. The Gemara asked the same question the next thing in the Gemara. So the Gemara agrees with you. But this was the point of view of, who was it? Rabbi Chanina, there are those who say Rabbi Yoshaya. Okay? That was their point of view. The next point of view that the Gemara is going to express is, that's ridiculous. What kind of punishment? There's no reason for punishment. Okay. Any other comments here? Yes, Dad.
The issue of whether or not Moses has all of the laws, I think, is a big issue. So is he knowledgeable about all of the laws at this point, or is he still in need of learning about more laws?
The truth is that we know the answer. There are two cases in the Torah, and they're both brought here on this page, where in fact Moses has to make reference where he doesn't know the law. And that's why you have this reaction of Rabbi Yoshaya. This is one case. The other case is the case of the Mekoshesh Eitzim. A man is found gathering sticks on the Sabbath. And there too Moses has to bring that case to God. So those are the two cases that you have in the Torah.
When Aaron, he chastises Aaron, and then Aaron explains what he did. And I guess that's different. Why he didn't eat, why Aaron would partake. Moshe and the Torah says, I do not.
But he doesn't have to ask God at that point, does he?
No. It's just addressing the issue as to, I think we assume that at some point, at least at that point in the narrative, that Moshe, everything is revealed. So for him to say, oh, I didn't know when Aaron corrects him about...
That would be where Moses errs in terms of the application of the law. Like, there is no new law there. Moses simply doesn't apply it appropriately. Aaron shows him that he wasn't applying the law correctly. Here we have no idea what the law is. It's a similar question, but it's also a problematic question as far as the Mekoshesh Eitzim goes. The Mekoshesh Eitzim, the case where a person is collecting twigs on the Sabbath, and Moses has got to get the law. So the question there among the rabbis is, why is it a question? We know that an infraction of the Sabbath law is punishable by death. So why is it an issue? Why does Moses have to go and ask anything about it? Because it already says that the infraction of the Sabbath law is punishable by death. The answer then is, well, the infraction is punishable by death, but we don't know which kind of death. That is what Moses has to see clarification about. Okay, because you remember, this Gilas, Refa, Chenek, and Herig, and Chenek. There are four types of death. So that's the issue that he didn't know the answer to. And also, we'll see, the question is, why didn't he know it? Okay.
It could be great that the second generation would not survive.
I didn't get you.
Karet.
A karet.
Means that maybe this guy, the guy who picked up the wood, will be alive, but the second generation will not survive.
Yeah, but this is not a case of karet. It says mochumat.
This would be
yes.
A straight mochumat.
This is a straight mochumat. Okay, now let's go on. Matkifla, Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, attacks this whole approach. He attacks the whole approach. Mi kativ v'yashmiachem. Is it written, and I, Moses, will cause you to hear it? Moses doesn't say, I will be the one who will in fact tell you the answer to the problem. Ushmativ, I will listen to it. It says, Ushmativ. That is to say, Moses is in fact saying, I'm not going to be the source of this, I will listen to the divine word on this. So Moses didn't do anything wrong. Okay? Igamirna gamirna. If I know the answer, I know it. Iloa zlina vagamirna. If I don't know it, I'll go and learn it. Alright? So, in fact, he is justifying Moses. The Gemara is now attacking the two rabbis who saw Moses as having erred. Moses really didn't do anything wrong, they say. Well, let's sustain this. Hold on. Let's sustain this whole approach. Okay? So here you say, according to Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Moses' statement was not arrogant. The Gemara explains why, according to this view, Moses was not taught the laws of inheritance along with the other laws of the Torah. So we're still left with that problem then. So why then isn't Moses taught these laws ab initio, instead he has to make a special request to get these laws? Ela kedatanya. You can understand why this was if you read the following Baraita. Ri'uya parashat nachalot shetikatev ayedeh Moshe Rabbeinu. The passage about the laws of inheritance should have been written in the law through Moses, our teacher. That is to say, it should have been taught by God to Moses together with all the other laws. Ela, but, why wasn't it? Shezachu benotzalof chad v'nichtav al yadan. It was done for the sake, not of Moses, it was not a punishment of Moses, but it was done in order to pay a compliment to these women. Right? Their fervor, their love of Zion was so great that the Torah and God wanted to point this out, and therefore he gives them special billing. Alright? That's a much better answer. That's a terrific answer. Alright? That's the real answer here. That the reason God sets this up now is because they were really worthy of it, and he wants to point out how unusual and how worthy they were. So, then the Gemara goes on and says, in the same way, the section of the Torah about the guy who collects sticks on the Sabbath, it should have been written by Moses originally, before the incident actually happened that he had to consult with God. Ela shenit chayev mikoshesh v'nichtava al yado. But since the Mikoshesh, the gatherer of the sticks, was guilty, it was written through him. Why? L'lamedcha shemigalgalin chova al yedei chayav. That you get what you deserve. In order to make a point that you get what you deserve, uschut al yedei zakai. So the Torah wants to show that the wicked get what they deserve, and those who are virtuous get what they deserve. Namely, the Benot Zalafchad, they got what they deserved, and this guy got what he deserved as well. That was a subtext in the way the narrative expresses itself. Okay? Back to that question.
What happened when Moses didn't know? Did he have to go back to God periodically to find out what to do in these instances?
No, apparently only twice. Just
everything else was done.
Everything else God said to him, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying. Right? The rest of it, and surely there was a big rest of it, is the application of the law.
Right.
And that God is not consulted about. And that's a very basic principle of the law as well. You cannot consult God about the law. You cannot consult God. You know the story, we did this a few years ago, where I did this with the Brothers Karamazov. Remember when we studied the Brothers Karamazov? And that was the case of the... What is it called in the Brothers K?
When we discussed
Kiddushin. Is that
where
it was? Yeah. There was the Grand Inquisitor. It was the Grand Inquisitor. The story of the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, where it's done, of course, in the Christian context, and Jesus is there to decide who is right and who is wrong, and the conclusion is, we don't want to hear what you have to say. All right? The classic story in the Talmud is the story about Rabbi Eliezer. This is in Baba Metzia, where Rabbi Eliezer comes to a conclusion different from that of the High Court, and he says, if I am right, let the stream go backwards. The stream goes backwards. And then the Talmud says that we don't listen to streams. And it says, if I am right, let the walls cave in. And the walls cave in. And the Talmud says, we don't listen to walls. And if I am right, let a divine voice come and say Rabbi Eliezer is right. And the divine voice comes and says, Rabbi Eliezer is right. And the Talmud then says, we don't listen to a divine voice. And then they ask Elijah the prophet and say, Elijah the prophet, what did God say when this was going on? And Elijah says, he smiled and he says, Nitzchuni banai, Nitzchuni banai. My children have triumphed over me. My children have triumphed over me. So that's your classic story of the Talmud, which is to say that once the law is in human hands, you cannot have a divine reference anymore. And there were only these two cases where Moses had to appeal in order to find out something from God, and we've got to explain some reason why it happened, because this is not the way the law works. The law is given. Once the law is given, it's in human hands. Okay?
See, I infer that the daughters of 12 God came to Moshe in humility as opposed to making an arrogant demand. Because to me, 12 God is Tal Pachat. I mean, they're living under this terrible shadow of fear. But does anyone ever make, whenever there's a name in the Torah, I look, because some of them are.
Good for you, Jeff.
Interesting. But does anyone ever comment?
I never read that before. It's a great comment. It's so good that I can't imagine nobody ever said it before. But it's worthwhile to keep in mind. It's great. It takes a man with daughters to be able to say it. Zel Pachat. Zlofchat. I can't think of any of the traditional commentators. It's something that you would expect out of the Hasidic commentaries, that they would certainly pick up on it. But as you know, only now will I start reading it with great thoroughness.
The one thing that's always left me unsettled is not any implication that they should have been suggested into marriage. would have alleviated the situation? Or could they not form a marriage? Could they never doubt?
That eventually is dealt with, as a matter of fact. Well, the marriage issue actually in the Torah postdates this. And the problem that is dealt with is if they can inherit and they marry who they would like to marry, then we have the same problem we started out with of a land moving from tribe to tribe. So there are limitations put on whom they can marry. They can only marry within the tribe so that the land will stay stable in the tribe.
Yeah, but every 50 years the land will come back to the original.
Doesn't matter. Well, they would... Doesn't matter.
Was there primogeniture?
Not really, because there is simply, it's interesting, not compared with, again, your case of Downton Abbey. The Downton Abbey case. Downton Abbey case is the oldest son that receives the entire inheritance. In the Torah, the oldest son receives a double portion.
By land or by whatever?
It's by value.
By value.
That's what we studied.
So you have to evaluate the land. I mean, if all of the value is in land, then you have to evaluate the land not in terms of square meters, but the value of those square meters, and that has to be apportioned appropriately.
Because the issue, I mean, primogeniture had a practical base, and then eventually you wind up with a plot of land that
Correct. That's right. That's a problem of this system. Well, but the way it's dealt with is what you just said. It's dealt with because...
Monetizing.
No, because everything is temporary. And every 50 years it goes back.
Uh-huh.
Goes back. Now, I don't honestly know what that means. Back to whom? Now, to whom does it go back to? Because there isn't a person. There is simply a family of people. So I really, that's not clear. But that's sort of the way it's being dealt with.
I mean, the thing that's so amazing to me every time I think about this is how unexpansionist Jewish religious values are. I mean, other religions seek territorial expansion. And here, the limits are set. They're defined, and there's an assumption that there will be a non-Jewish world as well. I think it's quite remarkable mindset that's underappreciated in terms of the delineation of the boundaries.
That's true. And I guess that's related to the fact that the delineator of the boundaries is divine. And once that's done, it's done. It's finished. The job's over.
And there's only so much divine land.
Correct. It's a very limited, it's a limited piece of land. It certainly is that. No, and so we're living with sort of the realities of that today. That's a source of tension. Certainly in the modern Zionist enterprise, it continues in the daily news. I mean, every day this is an issue today in Israel. You know, what is that land? But indeed, it doesn't go beyond that. Whatever those issues are, those are sort of essential issues in that piece of land.
You can't solve it by moving out.
You can't solve it by moving out. That's correct.
Were none of the wars that kings fought expansions?
Well, no, that is true. There were expansionist wars. David does expand the kingdom. He goes all the way up to Damascus. So there... During the period, that short period, it's a very short period of time, but even there, the question is, we have it till today. The question is, in the Golan Heights, for example, or which areas of the Golan are subject to the law, the sabbatical laws? Because the sabbatical laws are the laws of the land of Israel. That's the Holy Land.
There was no tribe living on the Golan.
And If you, well, no, there was a tribe. There were 2.5 tribes living up
there.
It's
not there. They're on the southern tribe.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. There is a border area in the Golan. The Golan today takes up really part of that original area, and then it's not all that area. But in modern-day Israel, that's got to be redefined. The kingdom of David is very short-lived. It's very short-lived. It's only during his lifetime. Solomon is able to keep parts of that, and after Solomon's lifetime, the entire system falls apart because the two kingdoms of Israel and Judah then are the reality from that point on. So there is an expansionist period. There is, that's true. There really is. It's a very short period of time. Amazingly short.
Does anybody mind if I close this window?
Go ahead. It's cold. It cooled off. It cooled off.
But in the south, though, like the southern areas of the Negev, aren't they not within the Holy Land as it is? I don't remember the first, but in that description, it's like Eilat. Eilat is outside.
Correct. I believe it's outside the laws of the sabbatical year. I believe it's outside. The Gaza is outside of the laws of the sabbatical year because that was Philistine. That was Philistine land. So when the Israelis were in Gaza, that was a very interesting setup. And the poor Palestinians, I mean, these people, if they could get their act together, there's such a tremendous market. There's a tremendous market. And the Palestinians make use of that to some extent, but there's a huge market if they could really get their act together, because the whole Israeli economy every 7 years goes into this sabbatical mode. And one of the ways to deal with that is through Palestinian produce. And although some of that may be problematic halachically, there's a tremendous area, like the whole Gaza area, where anything that's produced there is relatively easy from a halachic perspective, and there's a tremendous market for it. And the quality of the stuff, because when the Israelis were in there, the kibbutzim that were producing stuff, I can tell you, it became famous. When you would go in the marketplace, we used to pay, you'd pay anything that, whatever they would charge you, you'd pay, because the quality of the things coming out of Gaza was better than anything else. Absolutely the best. I don't know why it was so good, but it was. It was just what they were able to do. It's true, it has something to do with the land and what they have, but it's also the way they decide to produce things. And the tremendous amount of sunlight. What?
And the Israelis built a lot of hydroponic. I mean, they had a whole industry.
They had to highly develop the whole thing. I'm just saying that if they did it, somebody else could do it too, because they're not there anymore.
On a different issue, we talked about just things that we need to have at least 3 to start this small code.
Correct. Dayanim.
Dayanim. Mishpat Shlomo is one king, and he used to do it on a weekly basis. How did he, what is the...
Well, there are areas where you have the kingship, and that's a problem in Jewish law, the extent to which the king has power. But there are things that the king has power to do. The king has power, for example, to raise an army. Right? The court has no power to raise an army. In Jewish law, in the law of the Torah, the court has a check on the king when the king wants to go to war. Right? The Sanhedrin, and there is a Kohen who is specifically anointed for that purpose. He's called Mashuach Milchama. That's also in Horayot. But the Mashuach Milchama is somebody who is anointed for the purpose of this checks and balances on the king. But the king has the right to initiate an army and to initiate war. The same thing as we have in this country.
So how does the Sanhedrin act as a hedge against that?
Because it had to confirm the decision of the king. Yes, it had to confirm or not confirm, because there's, in effect, the king has a right to create a draft. and to confiscate property in certain circumstances. There are limits to that. The Sanhedrin has got to okay.
Is that the only area? I mean, I've never heard of this. Was there any analog in any other sphere?
No, he's only for that purpose. He's only for that purpose. The Kohen who has that job.
So that's a cult, but it's not in the priestly function, or is it?
Interesting enough, it turns out to be. It's not necessarily something I would have thought of, because I would have thought of it as a judicial function. That the legislature, and their legislature was just a judicial legislature, it's all the same. That would be the place from our modern experience. But somehow there are two levels to it in the Torah. One is the Sanhedrin, and the other one is the Kohen. This Mashuach Nochama. So it, and which is probably what it should be, because what it does is it unites the sort of the legal system with the ritual system, with the temple itself. The temple has got to have a piece of this, as does the high court. They've both got to be a part of war.
Did the priests have any other judicial function at any time? Were they ever questioned about things that they might be expert in?
They did in areas of certain areas of ritual law that related to the temple itself.
So they would act as consultants to the court?
No, they would. They were able to.
They would be the judge.
They would be able to judge those matters.
They
could function as judges, yes, based on their expertise. Okay, keep going.
Administrative law.
What's that?
We have a whole body of administrative law, which is done by the agencies.
Uh-huh.
We have courts.
That's true, that's right.
Whole administrative law.
We have a whole piece of the picture is administrative, that's right. Okay, we're down at 8A1 toward the bottom of the right side of the page. It continues now the exposition of these verses. Ketiv, it is written now in the first chapter of Deuteronomy, Ba'atzaveh et shoftechem ba'itahi, and I commanded your judges at that time, Uchtiv, Ba'atzavevchem ba'itahi. And it's also written in verse 18, I commanded you at that time. So in other words, there are two things. One is, I commanded your judges. And it also says, I commanded you. Okay? So it's going to go on and interpret this. So let's see what it says. The first verse is readily understood as an instruction to the judges to guide the people through enforcement of the Torah laws, but the second verse, which is directed to the people, requires explanation, as it were. The Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Simlai, said Rabbi Simlai, Azhara la tzibur shetehe emat dayan aleihem. The second verse, I commanded you, which relates, and it's just a few verses, it's actually one verse later. It's there in order to indicate, Azara la tzibur, this is a warning to the community at large, shetehe emat dayan aleihem, that people have a sense of, how do you say, mat, the terror of the judge, the awe of the judicial, that they feel that. Okay? That's the reason then for the second mention there. And because these are two things that are similar and they are quite close to one another, one is considered to comment on the other, and the other to comment on the... Each comments on the other, as it were, because they're so similar. The Azara la Dayan shehizbola tatzibur. All right? The one that says to the judges, you have to do as I commanded you. That is a warning to the judges that they have to be able to have patience for the community. Ad kama, how much patience do they have to have? Amar Rabbi Chanan ve'itemar Rabbi Shabtai, kasher gisa ha'omen et ha'yonek, as a nursing father carries the suckling child. In other words, the judge has got to have a great deal of patience. Okay? Now, I truly believe that this was meant not only to judges, but this was an ashara la rabbanut, for rabbis. I always say that to people who are expecting to be rabbis. You have to have a great deal of patience. What's that?
But are you telling the candidates when you speak to them before they come?
Well, I don't want to make it seem as if that in this congregation you need a great deal of patience. I don't want to convey that message.
Maybe I'm missing something, but I think of nursing mothers, not nursing fathers.
Correct. So exactly. So it's a mixed metaphor, really. It's definitely a mixed metaphor. And there the sense of it is, this is a quote, where is it from? From Numbers, where Moses, this refers to Moses' relationship to the Jews, that it's as if he were a nursemaid to his community. So, you know, anyone who is a leader in a community can tell you, every once in a while, you have to act like a nursemaid. I suspect doctors have to deal with the same thing as well. The things that people ask you to do, it's a little bit boggles the mind, but so it is in life.
Sublimate.
You have to have a tremendous level of sublimate.
When the first time I took my wife to Israel before we got married to meet my family, So my father, in the airport, when he met her for the first time, he said, Laurel, one thing in Israel you need to know. The only word you need to know is
Arbe Sablanut. if she was going to marry his son,
yeah,
and he's an Israeli, she should learn that principle very well, right?
She still remembers.
Is
there any other imagery throughout the Torah of that, of a father with a suffering child?
I think it's unique, and you can look it up to see. I think it's unique that the father is a suckling child.
In some respects, very emotionally, it's sort of a lot of
chutzpah
from
rabbis
to discuss
that. It's Moses. I mean, Moses is
If it just applied to Moses, yeah, Moses just apply to a more general kind of concept.
No, because usually you have the more natural concept, which is the mother.
Right. Well, that's why I was asking about the
It's very unusual.
Well, I think it's a good analogy, because if it was the mother, okay, it would be easy to come. You need a lot of patience if you're a father.
Because you can't really do the job, and you just have to be loving.
You just got to have patience. You know, to take care of the child, without all the wherewithal that the mother has.
But it's not only the suckling issue here. I mean, I think the suckling is
a metaphor. It's a synagogue.
Exactly.
It really is.
Exactly. Correct.
A woman could be a nurse, because it's a Oman or Omanut is a profession. So it could be the person who takes care of me.
That's also true.
So it's a professional.
It could be.
Because God says, hold him to you the way a nurse would hold.
Sublanut is related, same as root of seven, which is suffering and hardship. So it implies also that it's a hard job, and you have to be prepared, and it's hard, and it's difficult, and it's a suffering and a burden.
Exactly. That's definitely a burden. That's the point. That's the point of the metaphor. Okay? Yes.
I wonder if there's another sort of very subtext going on here about Moshe. Because when first I read this, when we read about Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yoshaya, I mean, they seem to be dismissed so quickly. It seems like a totally far-fetched idea that he should be punished. But when you think about it, Moshe is the one who initiated this whole system. He was judging on his own from the very beginning. He gets somebody, he sort of gives him an idea, so he doesn't go to God and get permission
the judicial system. He does it on his own. He tells everybody what to do. And he says, come to me if you got a really interesting and difficult problem. I mean, he's operating totally on his own here. The one characteristic that I typically wouldn't associate with Moses is patience. Right?
That's correct.
Not a patient.
That is a difficult problem for Moses. That's correct.
But he had so it's a little bit at the end of this little sugya, it's a little bit of a reminder that maybe he was being very arrogant and should have been more humble in the way he spoke about all of this. Because it is Mishpat Elohim, right? Part of the beginning of the verse is Ki HaMishpat L'Elohim. So he's saying, the idea that he should have said, it's up to God and I'll listen to you, but you have to get divine help always.
You're right. You're right. It's a good way to, I think that's a good analysis. It's true. It's true.
He was always defending each other to God, too.
Well, that's what he has to learn to do. He has to learn to do that, because at first he takes the tablets and he just breaks them, you know. But no sooner does he do that than he starts realizing, and the Midrash of course says that God says to him, now I don't need you to tell me that they did wrong. I know that. I need you to remind me that I love them, because I forget that. I feel like killing them. So the need here of the intercessor is to be able to remind God of love. That's really what he needs Moses for.
I mean, the first assumption, though, as to why Moses didn't delegate is not because of arrogance, it's because of duty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he may not have even felt he had the authority to delegate. I think your first assumption is that felt that he was the one who was the God's
director,
mm-hmm. Messenger, mm-hmm. or whatever.
It's also fair. It's fair.
Right. When we study other Hukim and Mitzvot, the sentence used to go, Kavedet Avicha Timan Lemanech, but
Yireh
Adonai.
What?
That you need to be afraid of
to be,
God,
okay.
Yireh Adonai.
Right.
And here, that when you come to court, you come before God.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
The Elohim. And they don't say it. You say you need to have the awe of the Dayan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So here they reduce the level
to the Dayan and not the God.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though we come in front of God. So I don't know why they reduce it.
Well, I think they already said the other thing. We saw them say the other thing where they used Elohim, and that Dayan has got to have a sense of, you know, the awesomeness of the place and the punishment to which he could be subject for abusing the system itself. So I think this is, you know, in reality, if you have a court system, one of the things that you do in the court system is induce a sense of a fear and awe that the system itself induces in the people who are coming into it, and that we have to our own day. I think that's all that they're saying. Let's keep going, because you see a little bit more of this. It's another example of it that's coming up here. Ketiv ki atatavo. Right? These are now two different places where the mention is made of Joshua, who will bring the people into the land. So the first one says, Ki ata tavo, you will go et ha'am hazeh. What the Hebrew is missing the follow-up there. Ki ata tavo et ha'am hazeh. You will come with this people into the land. Okay, God says I think that's God who is speaking. God says that to Joshua. You will go with his people.
Moshe
says it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Moshe says it. Thank you.
Before
he says this. So there, you will go with the people. He's one of the people. Okay, he's one of the people. Uchadiv, it is written also, Ki atat tavi. you will bring the children of Israel into the land. There, he has the emphasis put on his leadership, that he will be the one bringing the people in, as opposed to the first one, where emphasis is put on the fact that he and they are all coming into the land. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, Amar lo Moshe li Yoshua, Moses says to Joshua, Ata v'hazakenim shabador imahem, you and the elders of the generation who are with them, that is to say all the people, you're all together in this. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the second verse, God says to Joshua, Tol makel v'hach al kod kadam. Take your staff and bang them over the head. Okay? And bang them over the head. Dabar echad lador ve'en shnei dabarim lador. There, a dabar is a goat. There is one goat for the nation. Don't think that you're all on the same level here. Right? There's got to be one leader, and you've got to bring the people into the land. So this is the counterpart again of the judge. The people have to fear the judge, but the judge has to have a relationship to the people. He's got to be able to be patient for the people. Joshua, on the one hand, is one of the people. On the one hand, he's one of the people. He's got to realize that he and the people are all together. On the other hand, if he doesn't take his leadership role seriously and take his staff and, as it were, metaphorically now, bang it on people's heads, it's never going to work. Okay? So, similar.
At this point, did Moses know that he was not going to...
Yes, at this point, Moses knew that he was not going to go into the land.
He knew it from the beginning, though.
No, not from the beginning. No. He doesn't learn it till later on.
Poor Joshua. I mean, he's now... he's got his own problems. His children, he's the guy who's feeding him all the answers and has all the authority is now gone. He's the mortal having to be the military leader and the political leader.
Joshua.
So, I mean, this is a really tough act to follow, to say the least. And I always feel that Joshua is really in a very, very tight leadership problem.
Achad Ha'am has an essay, which is essentially an essay about Zionism, where he points to this. And he explains why Moses doesn't go into the land, because the necessities and the realities of leadership from that point will be so radically different that Moses, who was so good at what he did do, that he learned and adapted so successfully to his role, it's totally unfair to him to really put him into the other role. You needed somebody from a radically different background, and that was Joshua's background. Because in fact the challenges were totally different. Not that he doesn't get any divine guidance. I mean, he does get divine guidance there, but it's just a totally different situation for comparison between the two of them. Okay, any other questions? Well, I think we'll call it here, because that's a good breaking point. And I wish you a Chag Sameach. A wonderful holiday. Enjoy in every way. Not 2 weeks, 3 weeks.